Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Hello, I'm Tony Prideaux. An interim report was produced in late March. It's part of an ongoing review into professionalism in the further education and skills sector. The report and its proposals have provoked many strong reactions from IFL members over the past weeks. Well, the debate continues today. I'm joined on this panel by Sue Crowley, Chair of the Institute for Learning, Beatrice Groves, who's the IFL President, and Lizette de Cruz, who's a member of the Advisory Council. We've also got a group of invited IFL members, and we'd like to really hear from you. Underneath the screen where you're viewing, you can post comments. You can tweet us at #IFL_views, or you can phone us on 0207 960 6858. Before we get into the questions, Sue Crowley, if I could start with you, can you give us a little bit of background to the review?
Yes, thank you, Tony. If I start at the beginning, most of you will know that IFL was initiated in 2002 by a group of individual teachers and trainers, as well as stakeholders that included employer reps and unions. And I was one of the founder members, and we gradually increased the work that we did with our members slowly over 4 years. So by about 2006, we had 4,000 members. Not long after that, the government decided that everybody who was a teacher or trainer on a government-funded programme should be registered with IFL. And so that mandatory registration meant membership shot up into hundreds of thousands. And I can remember coming back to the office when the news was announced by Bill Rammell then, and saying the good news is it's mandatory membership, and the bad news is it's mandatory membership, because there's a real issue for members having to belong to a professional body. Over the years, I've come to realise that that mandatory membership was really important in those initial days, because when we ask members what they wanted, what they want most is a voice in policy formulation and implementation. They wanted status and they wanted professional benefits. And we couldn't have done as much work as we have done if we'd been a very small membership body. So for me, that was the really important bit. The government agreed to pay subscriptions for the first 3 years, but then the decision was made to stop that, so that IFL had to become self-financing, and to that finance would come from membership subscriptions, so individuals would have to pay. Some employers felt that that was sound investment in staff development, and so they paid for membership. Others felt that it was the prerogative of the individual to pay for their professional body subscription. And so what happened was there was a real issue for some people about the status, about being mandatory, about having to pay. The government intervened and worked with the employer representatives and the unions and IFL, and eventually decided that what we needed was a review of professionalism in further education. And that's where this has come from. I think that sort of covers it.
Thanks, Sue. Well, we've got our first caller. Good afternoon to you.
Hello, this is Michael Branwell, yes?
What's your question?
Well, my question is not so much a question, as I described earlier, as something you might think of as, does my honourable friend agree with, to put it in parliamentary language? I got my DEPLs. I started getting it when I was 59. I finished when I was 52. I learned so much that I find it very difficult to believe that there are people around who are able to continue in this day and age, as I did for a while, as somebody who had been a professional but not a professional teacher. And it is, I think, would you agree that one of the things to try and get more people involved in getting things like DEPLs would be to point out how much you learn and how very enjoyable it is, although it was very, very hard work, naturally, how very enjoyable it is, and how much you can learn, not just for the good days, because teaching on a good day is just a joy, isn't it? We all agree with that. But for teaching on bad days, when you don't feel like it, when you've got a lot of glum faces in front of you, you don't really want to take that much interest, and the professionalism you learn, or at least I learned from an excellent tutor on my Jettles course, was an enormous help then.
The other thing
I wanted to say is there any means of gently putting pressure on people who are very good teachers, but of course unqualified if they've come, as I did, from outside the teaching profession, to suggest that maybe it could be put to people that the insurance in colleges of further education, it only covers those who are properly qualified?
The whole issue of being properly qualified and also it being a kind of support is something that Michael was highlighting in his question. Lizette?
I think you're absolutely right, Michael. When I did my... I did it was Cert Ed. In my day, it was about 1999. I felt it gave me certain strategies on how to cope with teaching. Especially like on a good day, it's nice to, you know, sometimes you're a natural teacher, but on a bad day, you need to sort of draw on things that you've learned. So my teacher training, I remember just things that she said to stay calm, to listen to your student, to protect yourself, not to be in the same room alone with the student, to make sure, you know, just things that I could draw on. So you're absolutely right. I found it was very exciting, gave me the confidence to teach, and I think, you know, more and more people should do it, definitely.
Be gross.
I agree with you more there.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more, Michael. I mean, in many respects, it's almost an obvious thing. Shouldn't teachers be qualified? Well, yes, of course. You would expect it in schools, so why not expect it in further education colleges? It's for our good, it's for the students' good, it's for the employer's good, it's for society's good as a whole, that teachers should acquire a certain standard of proficiency in the kind of work they do. Not just because of value for money, but because of the long-term standards that we expect to see when people come along to take part in learning. And with adult education in particular, a lot of what we're doing is remedial. It's often second chance work. So for people of that sort, we demand the highest standards we can possibly get. So yes, it's great to do a qualification like Dettles, but even more so, it's very important that we should be guaranteed a certain kind of standard. And I think one of the problems with Lingfield is that is undermined by the report.
Mm-hmm. Michael, just very briefly, what was your reaction when you read that there will be no requirement of these proposals go through for a teacher to have a qualification like a Dettles?
My reaction to that would be a combination of disappointment and horror. It's very important. I mean, you talked about remedial work, you talked about working with adults. Yes, the teaching profession needs people who have been involved in a profession, who can teach from a professional point of view of their subject. But there's all the difference in the world, I think, between being able to have an encyclopedic knowledge of what it is you are teaching and being able to put that across safely and to put that across in a way that is acceptable to your pupils in that they have to develop out of that.
Michael, I'm going to have to stop you there, but thank you very much for your comments, and do keep the calls coming on 0207 960 6858. Let's take the first question from our audience. Can you say who you are?
Hello, yes, I'm Jeff Rebeck. I've been a teacher in FE for 16 years and I'm very proud holder of QTLS, by the way. In fact, it sort of leads on from what Michael was just saying, is that I have a big concern, I think a number of people do, about how the proposed changes are going to affect initial teacher education. And perhaps the panel could give us some views on what they think might be some of the unintended consequences of that.
Sue Crowley.
How long have you got? It's a really good question, because I think you do have to play it through. Again, picking up from what Michael said, because it's such a diverse sector, you can be really, really good at your subject. You can come in having worked in the in your subject-specific sector. But because we have so many different types of learners, programs, contexts in which we teach, and so many different learner needs, it's absolutely crucial that you have that pedagogical underpinning as well, the ability to teach as well as know your subjects. So I think that's an important one. One of the things that's bothered me is that there's been some anecdotal evidence coming through that schools are already advertising that you can be guaranteed to have qualified teachers if you stay on at school. This may not be the case if you go on to a further education college. That's an unintended consequence that really bothers me.
Is that your views?
I think it means, Jeff, that anyone off the street could teach, and that's devastating for the profession. We need to have standards, and we need to have kind of some order, sort of a systematic way of teaching. If anyone can teach, if it's deregulised, that means we don't have that. Some colleges that coast will continue coasting, as Sue, you know, has obviously pointed out, some, you know, in past debates. And, you know, sometimes colleges that do value teacher training, that they will continue to grow. But, you know, in general, to deregularise is madness, absolute madness.
Be gross.
It's part of a current trend within the UK to let the market deal with the problem. And I know Lingfield's very specific about the business of the professionalism as a relationship between the employer and the employee. Fair enough, if it is, that means that the needs of the powerful partner will be the one that will be largely served, and that tends to be the employer largely. And employer needs will vary from place to place across the country, which means that the required qualifications will also vary if this takes place. Now, that has implications for casualisation, which we already are as a sector anyway. We already are a sector of the contract culture, of short-term working, of part-timers. In process, this is not going to help in establishing a community of practice in which people feel a strong sense of commitment, where the qualifications that are required, the kind of practices and the kind of employment practices and the kind of systems in which people operate are purely down to whatever is needed in a local college. We need a much wider, a much broader, a much more communal approach to all that, which involves a standard teaching qualification. We're not going to get it out of this.
Jeff, how do you feel about the unintended consequences?
I mean, for me, the great fear is that we reduce FE teaching from a profession to a workforce, and that's what worries me. You know, that as a workforce, they will simply be people that are the ciphers, really, of what the awarding bodies and so on want to make of teachers, and the idea that anyone can come and do it is, frankly, ludicrous.
We've got a comment from Kevin Whitehead, who's a tutor at Burton and South Derbyshire College. You would not let your children go to a school where the teaching staff were not qualified. Why should adults be treated differently? Doesn't that get to the heart of the issue, Sue Crowley?
Well, it does, and it isn't just about the adults, because an awful lot of 14 to 19-year-olds are in colleges. And I mentioned this marketing ploy between schools and colleges, which is worrying, but it's also very divisive within the colleges and providers, because what you will end up with is some people who are qualified and some who aren't, and that's very divisive within the organisation. So I think there's a huge problem there, and I think there is also the problem that whenever there are financial constraints, the first budget to go is teaching, training and development. And that will probably happen in colleges that are under tremendous financial pressure at the moment. The commonly known as good colleges will find ways of supporting their staff. The colleges that are known to not be managing very well will be the ones that will cut that training budget. So it is likely that there will be a division between colleges as well as within colleges, and that it's that divisiveness that I'm very concerned about, Tony.
Any other comments from the audience here? Yes.
I have experience of learners with low esteem that would want to wait for you outside the corridor to ask you, are you a teacher? Having come from a business background, we go in, under the auspices of London Young Enterprise to talk to them, give them self-esteem. And by the time you finish, they're jumping up and asking you, sir, are you a teacher? So, you know, I mean, it is quite, you know, evident that having qualification as a teacher, a proper teacher, would, you know, add to boost, you know, the morals and the esteem of some of the learners with low esteem.
Thank you for your comments. We've got a remark from Gregor McGregor. It would seem that it's taken 20 years to almost get professional parity with school teachers. Is this a case of throwing the baby out with the bathwater? Be gross.
Yes. I mean, you would expect me to say that, really, in some respects. The baby was a very good one. The baby was a very controversial one, but the baby was included IFL. Not everybody was terribly happy about the business of IFL, but that was a funding issue rather than the business about the politics of education. What's increasingly happened since, however, is over the past couple of years, we've gone through a process of wanting to make sure that the marketplace system operates within across the borders of education. And that means, of course, that the qualifications also are up for grabs in terms of what is acceptable in a marketplace style. And I think that's why the baby goes out with the bathwater. It's about the business of standards and about the business of parity and about the business of where we sit in relationship to the rest of the education system as a whole, in schools, for instance, across and in universities. That's now up for grabs. It may well be in the future we'll end up with something much more flexible, but at the end of the day, the person who's going to suffer most will be those who are the learners, because they can't have no guarantee at the end of the day whether the person who's standing up in front of them is going to be adequately qualified and trained. The question to ask yourself is, do you want to go along to a course or a class or whatever you want to call it and be taught by somebody you don't know whether they're adequately qualified and trained? That's the question.
We need to take our next call, who is Neil Lees. Good afternoon, Neil. We seem to have lost that call for a second. Bee's point, though, Sue, what's your view on this?
Yeah. Well, I think you have to try and work out what the baby is and what the bathwater is. And I think the bathwater is very much around who funds a professional body. Most of the people who have been in discussing the issue about the funding of the professional body have been very clear that a professional body is needed. So the professional body maybe is the baby, but more importantly is the qualification, the initial teacher education. So for me, the issue, as you say, is around funding. That's the bathwater. The baby is having a professional body and a qualification that gives you the status so that you have the self-esteem that your students can then model. Coming back to the question that you raised, so it's absolutely fundamental.
We'll come back to the audience in a minute, but we've got another question from a member, Khurshed Bote. I hope I've pronounced your name right, Khurshed, Head of Programmes at Teacher Training. Does the government realise that the lifelong learning sector has a range of provision? If these changes in qualifications have to go ahead, please use this opportunity to bear in mind that the academic staff within some contexts is largely part-time, for example, in adult and community learning. I have to say that all our panellists are actually part-time teachers as well as being involved with the Institute for Learning. It's a massive issue, isn't it? This especially support for part-timers, isn't
yes.
it? Was
yeah.
that?
I've been teaching for 13 years. And I've always been part-time. And I think just having an initial teacher training has just given me a structure to, when I'm going into the class, to actually be able to teach. When you're a full-timer, you're in that structure, so you kind of naturally sort of know things. So again, you know, the teacher training just helped me to fit in a lot better. I feel that.
We've got another caller, Kurram Shafiq. Good afternoon, Kurram.
Good afternoon. I'm from London. I'm a lecturer. I'm a sessional lecturer at London Bridge College in London Bridge, and I also teach at High Wycombe, or in High Wycombe. My question is this. The Lingtor proposals recommend changing the naming of the DETL to a certificate education level 5, but it also says that, some of the award or part of the award will only be recognised. Does that mean anyone with DETLs will no longer be a qualified teacher? Does it render the DETLs obsolete? Will I be unqualified, basically, if the proposals are accepted?
Does it render the DETLs obsolete, Sue Crowley?
No, it doesn't. If you've gained DETLs, then you hold that qualification and that will be with you going into the future. The proposals, I believe, in the interim report suggest that there should be... there are two things happening. One is that initial teacher education should not be mandatory. And secondly, that the format of initial teacher education needs to be reviewed. So I think there are two things there. But no, the DETLs will be recognised as qualification going forward. So it's not been in vain.
Karam,
the suggestion was that you might be stripped of qualifications or whatever, and that's a concern to me and other teachers about the DETLs qualification as well. I've been extremely worried by this as well, and we don't really have a body to represent us, whereas the IFL was our kind of recourse, I suppose.
Can I comment on that? I'm very strongly a supporter of the concept of a professional body for everyone working within the post-compulsory sector, and especially within FE and adult community learning. I've been 32 years in this trade, if you want to put it that way, this profession. Mm-hmm. And in all of that time, there has been no organisation other than the trade unions who dealt purely with terms and conditions, which was willing to speak out about the way in which I saw the profession developing and operating. Now there is an opportunity to do that. IFL may not be the perfect vehicle for that, but it is the most powerful one of the lot because it's the one that's got the biggest voice and the biggest stake within this particular process. So I'm very supportive of IFL in that respect. That's why I stood as president, and that's why I think it's very important that we should continue down this road of having a strong organisation that can have that kind of voice.
Thanks for your call, Kuram, and do keep the calls coming, 0207 960 6858. We've got another question from Geraldine Timlin from City and Islington College. It seems quite mad to allow teacher qualifications to be left to chance or whimsy, she says, and is further evidence of the low status in which the teaching profession in England is held. Obviously, no one would attend a GP knowing that she or he may or may not be qualified to do their job. So why would we offer this kind of hit or miss to FE students? Is there an issue, though, in terms of funding, Sue Crowley? And yeah. Is this part of the drive here?
Yeah. I think, I agree with Geraldine. It seems mad. And so you have to think, well, what would the reasons be for making such a suggestion? And I think it must fall into two camps. One would be the funding issue, the cost of initial teacher education. And the second is a commitment to a market ideology. And so I would have thought those were the two drivers. But I agree with Geraldine. I cannot see how a 16-year-old who stays in school can be guaranteed someone who is fully qualified as a teacher. But if they go to the FE college, then that cannot be guaranteed. And that divisiveness and a discrimination between the two is hard to justify.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Good afternoon to you.
Hello.
Hello. Can you just tell me who you are?
My name's Mamuna Shah.
Hello, Mamuna. Thanks for joining
us.
What's your comment?
My comment on question was really around the use of casual staff. I'm in a bank, so about the background noise. It's around the use of casual staff in further education, particularly colleges, and the burgeoning use as well. And does the review recognise that we are becoming quite... Well, we are looking at the extent to which the casualised staff are being used to deliver what should be full-time or used in terms of full-time employees and quite reliant on that, and it impacts and does it recognise the impact on learning outcomes and the empowerment, the need to empower staff and actually disempowering the use of casualised staff because we're locked out of communications channels as well, and we're on different terms and conditions. So to some of you, is some of you looking at that and is it recognising the impact on learning outcomes?
B. Groves.
Yes, I'm laughing because I've experienced this over many, many years about the business of what it's like to be a casualised member of staff and to be on someone else on repeating contracts that go on forever and ever and ever. The call is from the sector, be loyal, be committed, be highly qualified, do your CPD, be the best teacher you can. But the other, when you ask for a permanent job, it doesn't happen. So consequently, there is a kind of disjunction between the demands of the sector in terms of what it requires from teachers and what it's willing to provide in terms of reciprocity, in terms of good terms and conditions of work. Now, if I leave that to one side and then just simply talk about qualifications, if I'm a part-timer doing 2 hours a week and that's all, do I really need a full qualification? And the answer is yes. I'm doing even though it's 2 hours a week, I'm doing exactly the same quality and standard of job as someone who's teaching full-time 5 days a week. It's really important to recognise that fact because without that recognition, the status and respect that that person needs will never be delivered. If they're treated as if they're a sort of second or third class tutor because they're only doing a couple of hours a week, they will never be recognised for what they are as an important component of the way in which adult education works within this country. So I'm a very strong supporter of the idea of a common qualification because it provides that level of status across the entire borders.
Can I come in there, Tony? Because I think there's also something about being felt to be an outsider. There are quite a few people in further education who choose to be part-time staff, and it's one of the rich aspects of further education in that you are still practicing whatever your specialist work is, and you're able to have that totally up-to-date stuff in your teaching. But what is important is that those people shouldn't feel casualised in that they're being outside. And one of the things I think the professional body can do is to minimise that effect through the communities of practice, through the online communities, through the CPD that we can provide in the regions. And so there is something about being able to unite those part-time teachers across organisations so that they do feel part of the sector. I think it's a really important point.
Mamuna, thanks for your call. What do you feel about what you've heard?
I think a bit of reinforcement of the way, there's a point to reinforce the way I feel that I want to be involved. And I'm not actually doing 2 hours a week, I'm actually doing 20 something hours a week. Yeah. So I'm actually contact hours, that is. Yeah. So I feel like I'm a full time member of staff, and yet these contracts, and a lot of my colleagues are in the same position, but these full time contracts are not forthcoming, and we would like to be on the same terms and conditions as our full-time colleagues, and I've actually gained QTLS as well.
Yeah.
So I actually think it's wrong to be employing people on these terms and conditions when they should be a fully integrated part of the workforce.
Mamuna, you're one of very many people who would state that, whether they're doing 2 hours or 24 hours. It's the fact that very often part-timers are treated differently, and often the requirement of training is something left to them, which at the end of the day I think is really important that we grasp, and I think it's one of the issues that IFL has to take on board very strongly.
Yeah. Mamuna, thanks for your call. Thank you very much for your call, Mamuna. Now, we've got another comment from John Wilson from Holistic Partnerships Limited. He makes the point that while he says qualifications are key, it would be nice if my professional body recognised that there are providers other than FE colleges whose needs are perhaps different. Is this an issue in the sector?
It clearly is for John, and I think that's what we have to hear, is that if you're feeling as part of the work-based learning provider sector, then you're not represented, then that's what you're feeling. But what I have to say is that some of our most committed members have come from the work-based learning sector, and they're also the ones to very quickly recognise, along with ACL, the importance of the recognition of the work that they do and the status that they have and the qualifications that they have. So I'm disappointed if that's the feeling. I know it isn't the feeling for all work-based learning providers, but I understand where that's coming from, and it's something that we will work on.
Well, I was going to ask the whole panel, what would the panel say to somebody from work-based learning who didn't feel entirely supported by the Institute?
I think we need to do an awful lot more work around that. But I think one of the crucial things that needs to be pointed out is it doesn't matter which area of work, which area of learning you're dealing with here within the UK, whether it's in work-based learning, whether it's state-inspired, whether it's private and private commercial. The learning principles are the same, irrespective of where you happen to be. It doesn't matter what the subject area is. And if you're going to train someone to be a teacher, you need to make sure that those particular principles are addressed within the training. So there needs to be a basic core qualification that someone can achieve to guarantee that. And I think, you know, it's one of those sort of no-brainers almost in that respect. We need to spread that message far wider as a guarantee of quality for people who are turning up to do work in whatever particular sector, whatever particular subject area we're talking about here. And I think there's far more work to do around that.
Tony, can I come in on that? Because one of the things that IFL is doing, it's working quite closely with the Learning and Skills Improvement Service, with ELSIS, supporting the inquiry set up by BIS again about adult vocational pedagogy. And work-based learning is going to be crucial to that because there's some of the most innovative teaching for vocational education is happening in that sector. And I think that will help raise the profile of the work-based learning sector.
And I think some of our members also, we've got some in the prison sector, we've got some in the health sector. So, you know, they aren't just in FE. We do talk a lot about FE. But that we have like a wide membership that is sort of like lots of different sectors. And we are trying to be more inclusive.
I have a nasty habit of talking about FE and using it as an all-encompassing term to refer to everybody. So please forgive me if that's the case.
Keep tweeting us on hashtag IFL underscore views. And phoning us on 0207 960 6858. We'll take as many calls and tweets as we can. James Bailey from South Staffordshire College has asked the very straightforward question, is QTLS staying?
That's not a very straightforward question.
It's a very short question.
But it's a good one, and it's a really important one that needs to be addressed. In the short term, most definitely yes. QTLS will remain, and it will remain with IFL until September 2013. What happens then is still, I think, part of discussions, and it will come out of the consultation that BIS has got out there at the moment, which is why it's so important that people actually do contribute to that consultation. We have nearly 10,000 people now who have QTLS. The Department for Education are keen that QTLS should remain as parity with QTS so that there is that cross-fertilisation between schools and FE colleges. Were the qualification to become voluntary as opposed to mandatory, then obviously less people will be able to gain that QTLS status. Because you can't get QTLS until you've got the qualification. So there is some area of uncertainty. What I'm fairly confident of is people who have already got QTLS and QTAS will be able to use that and it will remain recognised as valuable. And certainly the BIS research that they commissioned themselves has suggested that not only did the practitioners themselves see it as valuable in terms of increasing their confidence and their capabilities, but so do their learners and so do their managers. And so I think that's a really important point that needs to be raised.
Let's return to QTLS and, of course, Associate Teacher Learning and Skills status just after the next call. It's from Neil Lees. Good afternoon, Neil.
Hello.
What's your question?
Well, my question is, I mean, I just caught the end of what was going on there. I suppose my question is, if the proposals come to fore and QTLS is no longer compulsory, that means it's done too, really, but really what is the point of the IFL moving forward if that came to fruition?
What's the point of the IFL moving forward if QTLS becomes voluntary?
Yeah.
I there are so many layers to that question. I think a lot of the discussion that's gone before has raised the feeling of the membership that they want to belong to something that is larger than their organisation, that is about them working in communities of practice, sharing their expertise across the sector, and having a voice that government can listen to. And I mean, a really good example was the Wolf Report, where over 5,000 members actually gave their feedback. It's about having voice as well as status, and it's about being able to offer professional benefits. And the more people who are engaged in the organisation, the more we're able to do that. So I think that's my kind of general observation. I don't know about others.
How much do you value the Institute for Learning?
Well, I don't think that's really the question. I take what's just been said there, and I think that's a perfectly valid point. But I suppose my counter to that would be, and I'm being devil's advocate here, I'm not for one saying that the IFL shouldn't exist, but what I'm thinking is, why couldn't the Department of Education represent that, as they're going to represent QTS moving forward? I'm just trying to see what's going to be distinct about the IFL,
I think,
particularly if they're not receiving a membership fee anymore, that's going to make them anything other than just a purely academic organisation.
Do you think there's mixed messages coming out of government then?
Well, there's definitely mixed messages coming out of government, but there's nothing new about that. What I'm thinking is what the IFL is going to do as a riposte to sort of justify their existence outside of, you know, other than becoming some sort of almost faceless quango, I suppose.
I think the last thing I would want as president of this organisation and as a tutor is to end up being a symbol of an organisation that had no use at all. I would be the first to leave if that was the case. What I wanted to see happen is that whatever organisation we have in the future called IFL next year or the end of this year or whenever has a very strong voice and says the kind of things we've been hearing coming through today from callers and tweeters and people who've sent questions in. That's what I think the Institute's job is to speak very, very strongly for people like yourself. If we're not doing that, Neil, then really you have every right to criticise us for it. And I think that's one of the most important things we should be doing in future. We are the only... trade unions can't do that because they're primarily concerned with terms and conditions. We need an organisation that can be highly democratic, highly responsive, highly effective in terms of its questions it asks about the Emperor's new clothes of education. And I think that one of those things that IFL should be setting its targets on. I'm sure we will get there. I'm sure we will. I think we're one of the good things about Lingfield, I suppose you could say, is it's enabled us to have this conversation, which is a very positive thing. Mm-hmm.
And I think, Neil, it's up to the members to tell us what how they want us to go forward, because IFL's not just about qualified teacher status. It's about teaching, really, and it's what do you want us to do, and we will do it, because you are the members.
Thanks, Neil. One of our members has tweeted, "The effectiveness of any college will never be better than the quality of the teaching." Maybe I can just return to the conversation we were having before the call about QTLS, but also about associate teacher learning and skills. Now, doubts have been raised about this, haven't they?
Yes, they have. And this has been a debate that's been going on long before Lingfield and the Independent Review. It's very difficult because of the diversity of the workforce. It's very difficult to come to a conclusion about whether the associate status was the right route to go down. And I'm sure one of the things that will happen is that will be reviewed. That's not to take away from people who have got that qualification, because I think, you know, it has been quite rigorous. It's not the people, it was the designation that might need reviewing.
It's
my personal opinion.
Sure, but isn't this one of the big issues, that people that have put in the work and have worked and gained ATLS are now feeling a bit put out in the cold, potentially?
Yeah, so I can see why they would, but that is a shame, because it isn't about the work that they've done and the recognition that they've got. And again, the BIS research shows that that's not the case, that those people are much more confident, they're much more competent, and they're having a better impact on their learners. So it's not to take away from them. It was the notion of that associate role may be one that needs to be revisited.
Katie McComb from Walford and North Shropshire College is asking, how is it that FE should be allowed to manage its own qualities, but schools need to have regulation? This gets to the heart, doesn't it, of employers having more power now to determine what happens. Lizette?
I think it's totally wrong, Katie, that FE and schools are treated very differently. It's a bit like in the 1980s, FE was considered the Cinderella service. And I think because of this report and what the government are trying to do to us, we're in serious trouble that we're going to go back to that, you know, being the Cinderella service. There should be definitely more parity between schools and education, and definitely that, you know, if schools have to have qualified teachers, then FE should have qualified teachers.
Of course, almost at the same time that Lord Lingfield reported, there was another report from the government suggesting considerable gains have been made. How do you account for the difference between the two reports?
It's very difficult to account for it. Certainly the report that came out the day before the interim report was quite a detailed, intensive piece of research. And it was saying the tentative results, because if you start a new approach to workforce development, you can't expect it all to have happened in a year or so. And what it was saying was that all the indications are that the regulations have had an impact not only on teachers and their perceptions of themselves, but it looks like the impact is there on the learners. It's going to take a bit longer to be able to look at that in relation to learner outcomes, but all of the indications are that the learner experience is better when people have gone through that process of initial teacher education, the professional formation, through to recognition.
Tweet from Alison: teachers are professionals, but not sure if the culture supports them. Mm. It is all about the culture, isn't it, Beavis?
Oh, yes. I mean, it is. I mean, that's what a community of practice is all about. It has a certain unspoken ethics, ethos, a way of doing things, communicational systems, etc., etc. And unfortunately, the current culture we have in the UK, and especially in furthering adult education, tends to be highly managerialist, highly competitive, and at the core of it, a great deal of fear of people losing their jobs, fear of where the next funding is going to come from, fear of whether a project you've been involved in for a length of time, which you've committed a huge amount of time to, is still going to be there next year. And that doesn't cultivate a sense of security and a sense of progress and a sense of commitment, which is long-term. It's very short-termist. It's very, we're here today and gone tomorrow, in the terms of which employment practices and in terms of which qualifications operate. There's a very short-sighted view, and I think one of the biggest problems Lingfield has is its inability to criticise what has caused the issues within further education as far as professionalism is concerned. And part of the problem has been short-termist policies within government.
Can I pick up on that?
Can I just say for a second, I want to come to the audience in a minute to hear their views on what they've heard so far this afternoon. But Sue Crowley first, and then let's just go back to that other report for a second. But yes. Sue, what do you
want to
say?
I wanted to pick up on the notion of culture. I think it's a really, really important point, because the culture very much depends on the leadership of the organisations. And we've been working, again, with support from ELSIS, with a group called 157, which is some of the larger FE colleges, looking at how do you create a culture that promotes professional learning and a curiosity and an interest in learning from your learners. And we've just published with them a joint report called Leading Learning, Letting Go. And I think that summarises quite well what our research is saying, is that the leadership needs to trust the frontline professionals to carry out their own professional learning, their own CPD, to be innovative and creative and allow them to take risks. Really good teaching is about being able to take risks. If you're scared to take risks because of the culture you're in, you're never going to get that really, really good teaching.
Exactly.
And so working with the senior leaders is a very important aspect of the work we're doing currently.
Let's go to our audience now. Any comments about what you've heard so far?
Well, I certainly think you picked up on a really important point there, Sue, about the work, about the way that teachers can now support each other. I mean, the great value of QTLS to me is that it's peer review. It's my colleagues have awarded it, in a sense, and I think that that's where its real value comes from. So the one thing that the IFL has to offer us, and I think is so important here, is that it actually joins teachers together as a body, regardless of the organisation that they come from, and that there is that community and that sense of mutual support which comes with CPD and reflection, which I think, again, is so important. And I'm glad that that message has come out so clearly in what you've been saying this afternoon.
For me, it's about shifting from some people in the sector having power over other people in the sector and recognising that if we really want the best experience for learners, it's about power with. So the leadership need to work with the practitioners in one organisation need to work with practitioners in others, and if you all work together, then it's got to produce a better learner experience.
Lizette, I just wanted to pick up on that point from the audience, because in that government report that came out just about the same time as Lingfield's, one of the points they raised was that most of the adult and community and work-based learning providers in the study are requiring their staff to become fully qualified. That does show kind of buy-in, doesn't it, to this culture?
Yes, it does. Yes, it certainly seems to negate what they were saying about deregulation, because they've actually said that they, you know, they would like sort of staff to be qualified. So it's sending two different messages.
Sure. And there's also that issue, isn't it, for people that have some form of portfolio career who might be working across the different parts of that sector. How is there enough support for them?
I don't think so. I mean, this has been an ongoing problem for the past, well, as long as I can remember, there's been this issue. If I already do work for at least four different employers across Tyneside, where I come from, and each one of them believes that they own me 100% when they don't. I am a professional across those boundaries, across those employer boundaries. My qualifications relate to the work I do across all the jobs I'm involved in. But the employers don't think in those terms. They think of their work. There is insufficient collegiality, insufficient cooperation, and insufficient insight into the way in which education operates outside of organisational boundaries. And I think that's been caused primarily by this culture and ethos of competitiveness, treating education as if it was a business, looking in terms of bums on seats, and grading processes, and the business of being best and being competitive, being somewhere in the hierarchy of good or not good as being a college or an adult education provider. These issues militate against this concept of a culture and an ethos which we can grow in as teachers and which students can grow in as learners.
And Ankyla makes the point, CPD and proper training is a must if you want to maintain professionalism in teaching. What do you reckon is going to happen to continuing professional development? And maybe I'll come back to the audience about this in a second as well. But first, Sue Crowley, in this new proposed regime, what would happen to CPD?
I think it's probably more useful to think about what's happened to CPD over the last 4 or 5 years. And partly the work we've done in looking at what people do, analysing what people do, looking at where CPD is most effective, where it has most impact, how you feed that back to the sector so people can improve in the way they do it. I think that's been fundamental. I think there is a language that we have now that we didn't have 5 years ago. So many teachers will talk about reflective practice, professional dialogue, the importance of sharing their professional development with other people and therefore spreading it. So I think there's been a real culture shift amongst our members about how they view and value CPD and the obligation they have to share that with others. My worry would be if people do not commit to carry that on, then we've got a problem. Now, my feeling is that the majority of members out there will carry on doing CPD regardless of what any regulation may say. And our evidence suggests that the mandatory requirement was for 30 hours for full-time people. On average, they do 49. So clearly there is a commitment that they are professionals out there. What I think could be missed is harnessing that CPD and being able to feed it back out in a very useful form. So I don't think CPD will stop, but I think the sharing of it and the improving on the way you carry it out could be lost.
We've got another comment from somebody called JS. I've spent many years and a lot of money gaining the qualifications needed to be able to teach. My qualifications, QTLS, and my membership of the IFL has, I believe, increased the value of my role, and I'm now regarded as a well-qualified professional. I would be extremely disappointed if the goalposts were changed yet again. This is part of the potentially demoralising aspect, isn't it?
Yes,
because
it is.
In a sense, this sector has only just got some kind of parity with school teachers. And is there a possibility now that that parity might be eroded?
I think so. I think new tutors coming into this system for the first time are going to find it very difficult to work out exactly what being a qualified teacher would mean. I think those of us who have been involved in the business of trying to work out what parity meant in terms of the two sectors are going to find ourselves now wondering whether what that agenda will be in the future. So vagueness will now become an issue, almost a competitive vagueness, as you might say, where it will vary from place to place throughout the country and how this works. Yes, there will be very good institutions and very good employers who will be very much supportive about CPD, about QTLS, about the whole business of status, and they're the ones, I suppose, who will be the models for everybody else. But there will be many who will look on this as purely down to one thing, and that is, can we afford it? It'll be down to things such as the big problems we had in the past, such as CPD, which was all about sitting in a room and being told how to fill a form in, which I've had on many occasions in the past. And I think that's crucially something we should try to avoid. One of the great things that IFL's 30 hours of CPD rule was made everyone do is think about what they were going to do in terms of CPD every year and think about the quality of that CPD. So generally speaking, it drove the quality up. And now it's all up for grabs again.
I think there's one thing, though, I'll say this to JS, but I think it's to lots of people. If you have been out there and you've done the qualifications, you've got the training, you're constantly learning, you've done QTLS, you've gone through that formation process, nobody can take that away from you, regardless of what the regulations say. And if it's improved you and the way you work with your learners, nobody can take that away either. And I think it's worth remembering that, you know, although I agree with everything that B said.
The interim report did raise some harsh realities, though, didn't it? And one of them was the fact that the membership of the Institute for Learning has fallen from a peak of 180,000 to around 90,000. Is it time for a look at the IFL's role?
Well, I think there are several points to be made there. First of all, the number of people working in the sector has dropped substantially. And both BIS and IFL reckon it's something like about 140,000 now. It's dropped considerably and falling. It is difficult for us to see exactly what the way forward is. I've talked about the fact that size matters before, and I don't think we can offer the voice and the status and the professional benefits that people really want if we're a very small organisation. We will become a different type of professional body. So much will depend on that. But as the chair of the non-executive board at IFL, I can categorically state that the board are absolutely determined that we go forward as a professional body and we maintain those three strategic priorities that we've always had, which is increasing the status, increasing the voice, and increasing the member professional benefits.
Lizette, when you first saw this interim report, what was your personal reaction?
I was very surprised because I couldn't believe that the government would do that to deregularise, teacher training, because, well, just because Michael Gove, in his recent reports, he was saying that school teachers should even have an MA in education, and he was saying that the standards were slipping and that people needed minimum level 2 maths, minimum level 2 English, and then suddenly it's like a whole big turn that we don't even have to have anything. So I was just simply quite shocked, really, and horrified.
And as a practitioner, what value does the IFL have to you?
As a practitioner, I think it's good to have a professional body. It's something that you can fall back on. It's something you can ask questions on. It's something that raises the standards of teaching. It's nice to have on your form, if you're doing an application form, IFL membership body. I was a practicing beauty therapist, I still am, and we used to have bad tack. We have a professional body. So when you have a professional body, you're a little bit more recognised. It raises your status. So I think it's good.
Sue from Bedford College asks, what are the advantages to the next generation of changing the FE's teacher's role from qualified to unqualified? Any advantages?
Cheap, yeah. I think Lizette and I both say the same thing. If the only advantage I can think of, it's going to be really cheap, much cheaper than before. Mm-hmm. But you're also going to get really cheap teachers. Yeah. Cheap teaching.
Cheap teachers, and you can tell them what to do. I think the employers will be able to take advantage of them because the teachers won't know their rights, they won't know what to do. With initial teacher training, you get a lot of knowledge, safeguarding, stuff like that. Mm. And I think employers, with casualisation, as Bea says, they're going to take advantage of that. So I think it's important for teachers to have that standard, know that they're worth it,
A final question to you all. Where do you see the future of professionalism in the sector? Sue Crowley.
I'm very optimistic. We have at IFL, through the council that Bea presides over, been talking about what sort of professional body do we want to be, and therefore what sort of professionalism do we want. And my feeling, certainly when we engage with members, is that members want a professional body. They want a professional body that's promoting communities of practice, collaboration, rigorous reflection on your practice, and continuous learning. And that, I think, bodes very well, because if the teachers have got that commitment, that's going to be reflected in the way in which they support their learners. And their learners will have that curiosity, that need to carry on learning, the need to be recognised for what they do. So the membership gives me tremendous hope about the way we're going forward.
Lizette, what's your take?
I'm very worried, so I've got the opposite feeling to Sue. I mean, if the government can do this, which is quite horrifying, what are they going to do next? I seriously don't think the government know what they're doing, and they're just messing about with education. They're not valuing it. And if you look at other European countries where education's seen as, is worth it, I'm just seriously very worried. And it's all about, I think, money and funding and whatever, whatever sort of is trendy at the moment for the government. And I'm very, very worried about it.
Finally, Beatrice Groves.
This, if I was to be dramatic about all this, so I will be. Mm-hmm. This is a struggle over the soul of the profession. But the trouble is, we're not quite certain what we mean by the word profession and professional. We really need to spend more time working out what we mean by those terms. We need to have a statement, perhaps, a manifesto, a set of characteristics which we can pin our colours to within the sector, which we know and can be assured of in terms of when we're talking about the word professionalism and being part of a profession. We're not that clear about that yet, but I think one of the good things about having this sort of discussion is it kickstarts that concept and makes me somewhat more optimistic that we can grasp that particular nettle. We need to work on that over the next few months and years. We also need to make sure that the agenda of discussion around professionalism, standards, qualifications is within the professionals themselves. In other words, not just the members of IFL, though obviously because they're part of that system, they will have a lot to say, but also people who are not members of IFL, who will have. We need to discuss this particular issue, get some idea about what we mean by these concepts, and lead us forward into an understanding which will direct us for the future. So I'm still optimistic, but not just yet.
Thanks to our panel, for everybody here in the studio. Thanks to you for all your comments, tweets, phone calls. Keep up with the latest on the IFL website. That's www.ifl.ac.uk. There's also a link to the government website on the IFL website for the survey that they're asking for everybody to fill in. Have a very good evening.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.